stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yaki reporting. Airstrikes reportedly kill 18 in northern Syria. Syrian activists said today airstrikes, believed to be from Russian planes, killed at least 18 people and wounded 40 others in northern Syria. The raid is reported to have hit a busy marketplace. The area is controlled by Islamist fighters, including the Al-Qaeda-linked Nusra Front. It is not an area where the Islamic State group is active. Turkey said today it is returning the body of a pilot who died after parachuting out of a Russian jet that was shot down by Turkish forces last week. Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoglu said the body was taken to Turkey late Saturday and was being treated according to Orthodox tradition. Russia and Syrian forces rescued the plane's second pilot, while another Russian soldier was killed during the rescue effort. In Burkina Faso today, voters are casting ballots for their next president and parliament. Emily Uob has all the details from Ouagadougou.
14 candidates, including two women, are running in what is expected to be a hotly contested poll.
Il y a une tendance entre ces deux partis politiques et vraiment on sent que...
Voter Alain Colombo says there are two parties who are head-to-head in this election. He said that they can feel it will be tight, not like before, when everyone knew for sure the leading party was going to win the elections. The two frontrunners are the long-time opposition leader Zéphirin Diabré and former Prime Minister Roch-Marc Christian Kabore. Security is tight, with close to 25,000 security personnel deployed across the country. Analysts say a second-round runoff is likely. Emilia for VOA News in Ouagadougou.
We invite you to visit our website anytime. You can get the latest news, and you can also listen to other programs we have. This is VOA News. Pope Francis landed in the Central African Republic today, the final stop of his three-country African tour. He called for unity during a visit to a camp for people displaced by the country's nearly three-year war. VOA's Chris Stein reports from the capital, Bangui.
In the Saint-Sauveur displaced persons camp, Pope Francis was greeted by children waving signs with words like peace, forgiveness, and justice. Pope Francis said the country needs love, peace, and understanding to end the crisis. Pope Francis is scheduled to visit the PK5 neighborhood on Monday, an enclave for thousands of Bangui's last remaining Muslims. The neighborhood has been the site of repeated clashes between Muslim and Christian militiamen. The Pope's visit did not end the violence. A local resident who spoke to VOA said two people were killed near the neighborhood on Sunday. Chris Stein for VOA News, Bangui.
Hundreds of thousands of protesters joined worldwide demonstrations today, calling for adoption of global environmental controls as world leaders headed to Paris for the opening Monday of the United Nations Climate Summit. Activists linked hands in the heart of the French capital amid tight security in the wake of the deadly Islamic State terrorist attacks earlier this month that killed 130 people. But peaceful protests turned violent, with police firing tear gas at a small group of demonstrators and arresting about 100. More than 2,000 demonstrations occurred or were set for today elsewhere, including in Perth, Australia, Berlin, London, Sao Paulo, and New York. The Philippines has received two new fighter jets from South Korea, marking what the military calls a return to the supersonic jet age. 10 years ago, the Philippine Air Force retired its 10 remaining F-5 fighter jets, whose maintenance had grown costly. The purchase of the new FA-50 trainer jets is the first order for fighter aircraft in nearly four decades. Lieutenant Colonel Rolando Pena is a pilot in the Philippines Air Force.
Of course, we are very much elated and we are very proud that we have this state-of-the-art aircraft. We've flown a push-pull cable, a subsonic aircraft, the S-211. Now that we have the FA-50, it ushers in a new history.
The FA-50 has night vision imaging, which is good for night or day missions, and can be outfitted with short-range missile-to-missile or air-to-ground missiles, among other combat features. The U.S. federal government has ended its bulk collection of data from the telephone calls of millions of Americans. The move follows a controversy that erupted with disclosures about the secret program by former government contractor Edward Snowden. The U.S. National Security Agency, in charge of the bulk telephone metadata program, is replacing the practice with more tightly targeted surveillance methods, the National Security Agency said. Reporting from the nation's capital, I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
He says he's very, very proud to vote today. He says voting today is a form of fight, just like we fought to get these people out, he said.
Burkinabes choose a new president and parliament Sunday.
We have a lot to learn from him, especially in the world of temptation. The youth are having a lot of temptations at the moment.
Pope Francis arrives in the Central African Republic on the third leg of his African trip.
Our mission is to support efforts to strengthen justice and accountability measures in Africa. It's a very broad mandate.
And prominent African legal experts form a group to help support efforts to strengthen justice and accountability measures in Africa. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Burkina Faso, more than 5 million voters head to the polls Sunday to elect their new president and parliament. The elections are meant to restore constitutional rule a year after former President Blaise Compaoré was toppled after 27 years in power and a failed coup 2 months ago threatened to derail the transition process. For VOA, Emily Eo reports from the capital, Ouagadougou.
At the crack of dawn, lines of voters were forming in front of polling stations in Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou.
Après l'insurrection que nous avons connue, nous souhaiterons avoir des dirigeants que nous avons choisis nous-mêmes.
Voter Moussa Banao says after the insurrections that has happened, now they want leaders that they actually choose. That is what motivated us to come out and vote today, he says. Just over a year ago, massive popular protests across the country forced then-president Blaise Compaoré to resign and flee the country after he tried to change the constitution in order to extend his already 27-year rule. For voter Mohamed Ouadriogo, voting is the continuation of that fight. He says he's very, very proud to vote today. He says voting today is a form of fight, just like we fought to get these people out, he said. Under Compaoré's rule, voter Amadou Wanga was old enough to vote, but never did. Today, he was among the first in line. Wanga said it is the first time he is voting. He says now that Burkina has a real democracy, this is why we come out to vote. 14 candidates, including 2 women, are running in what is expected to be a hotly contested poll.
Il y a une tendance entre ces deux partis politiques et vraiment on sent que...
Voter Alain Colombo says there are 2 parties who are head-to-head in this election. He said that they can feel it will be tight, not like before, when everyone knew for sure the leading party was going to win the elections. The 2 frontrunners are the long-time opposition leader Zéphirin Diabré and former Prime Minister Roch-Marc Christian Kabore. Voter Issa Korogo says he hopes everything goes well.
L'espoir est que, bon, qu'on ait un président au nom de tous les Burkinabés.
And he says he hopes voters elect a president in the name of all the Burkinabés so that the situation in the country can go back to normal. Security is tight with close to 25,000 security personnel deployed across the country. Analysts say a second round runoff is likely. Emily Yap for VOA News in Ouagadougou.
On his second day in Uganda Saturday, Pope Francis visited a youth event. Young Ugandans expect different things from the Pope and the Catholic Church. But one thing is clear, they want leadership. For VOA, Sejinio Rosblad has more.
It was a cheerful atmosphere, with the Pope attracting a large crowd at the Kololo Airstrip youth event. Many young Ugandans wanted to see the leader of the Catholic Church from up close. But the event was more than just a celebration of the Pope's visit. Many hope to learn from the pontiff, like 23-year-old Tom Asaba.
We have a lot to learn from him, especially in the world of temptation. The youth are having a lot of temptations at the moment, and we believe him giving us a word of hope, it can really transform the youth in Uganda.
Young Ugandans, who make up 70% of the country's population, face many issues, including widespread unemployment. Anthony Kabaka, a young Catholic priest, thinks that the church can help the government improve conditions for young people.
So if the government And the church draws a strategy to help these youth. The church can really get involved to bring closer those services to the youth and also educate them on the morals, which will help this project to catch up and maybe a result comes up.
The church already has successful programs that tackle youth unemployment, says Asaba.
The Catholic Church has done a great job in terms of employment here. Each year, at least they come up with several programs that engage the youth, especially for various job opportunities.
Besides unemployment, the changing climate and the role humans play is also a matter of concern to some youth, and they believe that the Catholic Church, led by the Pope, can offer ways to change, says Isaac Kabongo of the Ecological Christian Organization.
The Pope's call for all Christians, as well as any Christians, to protect the environment and respond to the challenge of climate change is what we are really very much interested in.
Pope Francis told the young people that if they want to see change in their environment, they need to take it up themselves with the power of Christ. Serginho Rosblad for VOA News, Kampala.
The Interreligious Council of Uganda, or IRCU, plans to hold a presidential debate on January 15 ahead of next year's presidential, legislative and local elections. This will be the first presidential debate where all of the 8 participating candidates have officially committed to be part of it. Joshua Kitakule, the IRCU Secretary General, told me that prospective Ugandan voters would have the opportunity to weigh the policies of all the candidates before deciding on whom to vote for in the presidential poll.
Yes, the Intelligence Council of Uganda is planning to organize the first presidential debate on the 15th of January 2016. We have been working with the managers, the agents of the 8 presidential candidates, and we want to make sure that all the candidates appear for the debate. We've already written to them, and some of them have committed themselves, including the president himself, yesterday in an interview in Gulu, that he will be available for that debate. Ugandans are real anxious about this debate because we think that through this process, the candidates will be able to explain their manifesto to the country, but also to international community, but also they will be able to ask each other questions, and then it will give them opportunity to clarify some of the issues within themselves that they've been talking about. So we are really hoping that this will be successful.
Well, I heard some Ugandans saying that it must be a big relief since President Museveni has agreed officially to be part of the debate, since they said he was the only one who possibly might be holding out, because for years people have been calling for such a debate. Opposition politicians particularly have been calling for debates. What changed?
Of course, he has always been committed, only that the public did not know, because the Intelligence Council of Uganda had earlier on spoken to him, and he had said, yes, he would be willing to appear for the debate. But I know that in the campaigns, Dr. Besigye has been asking for that debate, challenging him in that debate. And so yesterday, he just confirmed his earlier commitment to definitely appear for that debate.
Now, Mr. Kitakule, what should the people of Uganda expect from this specific debate?
I think what people of Uganda should expect is that they will now have the opportunity to listen at the same time to the different manifestos, the different plans that these presidential candidates would want to do for this country. Because what is happening is that most of them are going to different places, and not many Ugandans are having the opportunity of listening to each one of them. So we think that once we bring them together, then they will be able to articulate their manifesto there and then, and people will be able to judge at the same time who presents the best opportunity for Uganda moving forward.
Have you planned about how many minutes per round will each presidential candidate get in the debate, and how long will the debate be, since this will be only one debate ahead of the election?
We are looking at a debate of 2 hours. and maybe 1 hour off air, so about 3 hours. So we're thinking that if this is not enough and there is demand, public demand, and if the candidates feel that we should organize a second debate, then we can actually do that early February.
How has been the reaction of Ugandans since President Museveni decided to be part of this debate? Of course, the opposition politicians have always asked for this.
I think Ugandans are very excited because there was an untapped area and he did not show up for this debate. So this time around, once he confirmed that he's going to participate in the debate, many Ugandans are excited. They are very anxious because then they will be able to have these powerful candidates, Dr. Besigye, Amama Mbabazi, President Museveni, same time, articulating their issues, articulating their manifestos, and Ugandans will have an opportunity to choose out of them, among them, the best president to lead them in the future.
You think by so doing, next year's election, Ugandans will be better informed to choose the best candidate among them?
I think so. It's one of the ways. It's one of the ways that people can make an informed choice by listening to all of them at the same time and by securing commitment from all of them at the same time, many Ugandans will be able to decide then, because there are many Ugandans who are still not yet decided on who to vote. But I'm sure that this debate will help to clarify most of the issues, but also present the best candidate to Ugandans. And so I think that the debate is important in shaping the choices for many Ugandans who are not yet decided.
Those Ugandans who are uneducated, how can they be catered for in this debate? Oh.
It is something we've talked about, but I think it's something to think about because we have television that can broadcast in local language. We have radios that can broadcast in local language. It's something that we can think about since we still have some time. It's a good idea. We'll think about it, and I think it's important that we think about it because I know that many rural Ugandans do not speak English, but yet they would be interested in listening into the debate.
Joshua Kitakule is the Secretary General of the Interreligious Council of Uganda, or IRCU. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The Africa Group for Justice and Accountability was recently launched on the sidelines of the International Criminal Court, or ICC, Assembly of State Parties in The Hague. Atalia Molokomi, the Attorney General of Botswana, who is a leading member of the newly formed group, told me that members of the group will help support efforts to strengthen justice and accountability measures in Africa.
Our mission is to support efforts to strengthen justice and accountability measures in Africa. It's a very broad mandate, but obviously, having been, you know, launched here at the Assembly of States Parties to the Rome Statute of the ICC, there is a special interest that the group has in issues to do with the International Criminal Court, because clearly the ICC is the only court at the moment at the international level that deals with issues of, you know, crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, and so on.
Although the group has a broader objective than that, the African Union has been quite skeptical with some of its leaders about the objective of the ICC, and some of them have even called for non-cooperation. How do you bridge this divide, especially when the objective is to strengthen the judiciary system on the continent?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, because clearly, if we would like to work in Africa, our own Pan-African organization, which is the African Union, would have to be taken into account. Their views would have to be taken into account when it comes to issues of the court. But my response would really be that, you know, I actually don't think that there is a conflict or a contradiction inherently between the African Union. Its Constitutive Act, for example, you know, says that the AU is committed to fighting impunity on the continent. So in principle, the ICC should be a welcome, you know, institution for the AU.
Why now? Why was the group formed, and why now? I mean, the question then is, why this timing? What is the significance of this timing?
You know, I think the significance of this timing also to goes back to your question, which is that the court is facing challenges to its legitimacy, even in the eyes of some state parties. Remember, one of the things we want to do in strengthening the support is to capacitate the national or the domestic jurisdictions of countries that are parties to the statute to be able to play a complementary role, to cooperate with the court. Because many of us, even those of us who are very committed to the Rome Statute, are not necessarily in a position from a resource point of view, from a skills point of view, to fully cooperate with the court in the manner contemplated by the statute. So really a group like ours is about not just discussing the issues, it's also about concretely doing things, capacity building, and so on, of prosecutors, investigators, and so on, to make sure that the Rome Statute becomes a reality.
What should Africans expect from your group going forward?
Look, this is a new group. We emphasized 2 days ago when we were at the event where we were launching it. We are still really talking about the very concrete ways in which we can contribute to strengthening or to supporting the efforts to end impunity on the continent, the efforts to ensure justice and accountability in Africa. It's a very broad sweep. And so what Africans can expect is a group of people which might actually become wider, that will be prepared to serve the African continent, the state of Africa, the civil society of Africa, the people of Africa, to serve them insofar as ensuring that impunity on the continent does not happen, to capacitate, as I said, national stakeholders, prosecutors, investigators, and to work with others who are already working in the area. I think what they can certainly expect is support to end impunity and to strengthen accountability on the continent.
Atalia Molokome is the Attorney General of Botswana. She spoke with me from The Hague. Meanwhile, Navi Pillay, the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and a leading member of the Justice and Accountability Group, told me that members of the team would also seek to enhance cooperation between the African continent and the International Criminal Court, or ICC.
One of our goals is to enhance cooperation between Africa and the International Criminal Court. We are very much interested in initiating and supporting efforts to strengthen justice and accountability measures in Africa. I myself, as a former High Commissioner for Human Rights, have learned it's easy to criticize, but can we get together and try to be more helpful? So that's the goal, and I'm very, very happy to be part of this group.
Now, with what you have described, what do you think the prospects are of achieving your objectives, aim, and aspirations for this group?
Well, firstly, I like the idea that we're going to be covering both domestic and regional capacity building across Africa, giving advice and outreach. That means giving out the correct information, that this will reach civil society organizations. As part of democracy, we need the full participation of NGOs. And I found in Africa in particular, many of African countries, there isn't much scope for civil society organizations, either because they don't have the correct information or their freedom of expression is not necessarily encouraged. So we can do it by way of advice and building the capacity of civil society organizations. Also announcing the institutions, the regional institutions, for instance, the African Union's many institutions, including the Commission. And also, I come with experience of working closely with governments. In the world today, we are all so alarmed by conflicts, terrorism, and so on. But nevertheless, the majority of the countries I find are trying to improve their human rights record, trying to enhance protection, trying to prevent conflict in their countries. These governments who have that kind of will power to do something need assistance and support. So we just formed ourselves as a group. We still have to raise funding. And above all, we're not going to form the program and activities amongst ourselves and impose it down. We're going to firstly have very wide consultations and assess what it is people on the ground would like us to do. So in other words, Peter, here's a group of highly qualified, experienced experts. We got together. We want to give our time to this. And our first step, we're going to be meeting in March. The first step is to meet with civil society actors on the ground and see what it is they identify as the activities we can come up with.
Well, the question then becomes financing the group. How will you go about financing the group? And as the saying goes, he who pays the piper calls the tune, because some people are a little bit suspicious when it comes to groups such as yours, funded not from Africa, but from abroad.
Yes, I'm also very, very concerned about that, because as a UN High Commissioner, we also depended on funds. And who gives these donations are the rich countries. You can't go to poor African countries and ask them for aid. And let me also say that almost every African government receives funding from Western countries. Or that doesn't mean that we're going to be influenced or be donor-driven. It's necessary we get the funding, but when you have reached this level of experience, there is no way we will lose our independence just because we are receiving funding. Unfortunately, we do need funding to do this kind of work. We still have to start raising the money, of course.
Now, let me ask you, what impact do you think your group will have specifically on Africa?
Well, firstly, there are very many existing bodies, both academic and NGOs, who are working on this. And I feel if we work together with them, we can help to strengthen them.
Navi Pillay is the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She spoke with me from The Hague.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, after nearly 2 years of fighting the Ebola pandemic, Sierra Leone announced last month that the nation was Ebola-free. Guinean officials have declared that they will also soon be free of the virus. Join us Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Chaka Sali and his guests discuss the battle to completely end Ebola in West Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Next on Let's Talk, punctuality. Does it matter to you? Does it affect your views about someone when you meet to do business? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests discussing punctuality. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, right here in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, November 29th. The 2015 Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations kicked off in the West African nation of Senegal on Saturday. Eight nations are participating in the tournament, which is also a qualifier for the football event of the 2016 Olympics. The countries are host Senegal, South Africa, Tunisia, and Zambia in Group A, and Egypt, Algeria, Mali, and defending champion Nigeria in Group B. Three of the teams, Mali, Tunisia, and Zambia, are making their debut in the tournament, formerly known as the CAF Under-23 Championship. The top three teams from the tournament to represent Africa at the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Meanwhile, host Senegal got off its campaign to a winning start by beating South Africa 3-1 in their opening Group A match on Saturday in Dakar, Senegal's capital city. Ibrahim Keita scored 2 goals in the first half before substitute Issa Sarr sealed victory in the dying minutes of the game. In between, Funlami Nsagense grabbed a consolation goal for South Africa. In the second Group A match of the day, Tunisia defeated Zambia 2-1. Haitham Djouiné scored both Tunisia's goals, while Ronaldo Kampamba netted Zambia's lone goal. The tournament will run through December 12th. The 2015 Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations was initially scheduled to take place in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo. However, African soccer's governing body, CAF, changed the venue to Senegal. Turning to boxing news, British boxer Tyson Fury has become the new world heavyweight champion after upsetting Ukrainian Vladimir Klitschko in Dusseldorf, Germany on Saturday night. Tyson, who remains unbeaten, won the fight in front of over 50,000 boxing fans in a unanimous decision that ended Klitschko's 9-year reign. The judges called the fight 115-112, 115-112, and 116-111, all for the 27-year-old Tyson, who now becomes the World Boxing Association, International Boxing Federation, and World Boxing Organization heavyweight champion. All through the fight, the 39-year-old Ukrainian, who was caught under the left eye in round 5, simply couldn't pull the trigger. Klitschko finally started fighting in round 12, but it was too little, too late. In other news, former FIFA president João Havelange, who spent more than 2 decades in charge of world football, was discharged from a Rio hospital on Saturday after being treated for respiratory problems. Hospital Samaritano said 99-year-old Havelange was released at noon. It did not say when he was first admitted, nor give any other details. Havelange headed FIFA for 24 years and was also on the International Olympic Committee for half a century. But he resigned as honorary FIFA president in 2013 under a cloud of corruption allegations. Finally, athletics. Ethiopia's Bihanu Legese and Cynthia Limo of Kenya won the men's and women's titles at the 2015 Airtel Delhi Half Marathon in India today, Sunday. After an initial surge by Ethiopia's Mosinet Geremew, Legese overtook his compatriot with barely 100 meters remaining and crossed the line in a personal best of 59 minutes and 20 seconds. Geremew finished as the runner-up. It was the second half-marathon victory for 21-year-old Legese this year, having also won the Berlin half-marathon in Germany back in March. For her part, Limo took the women's race in 1 hour, 8 minutes and 35 seconds. Limo's compatriot, Hella Kiprop, was second. More than 13,000 runners took part in the Delhi Half Marathon. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now, sending it back to Peter Clote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports.
This girl is beautiful. She's beautiful.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Hold your one chameleon in a melody we call out. When you get a second saliva and a new mirror. When you cover the massacre, Kuba new mirror. She got a dip on her face, the Musariza. She's on my mind, that girl. Naya, yeah, you gotta get the katikoleti. And the same massacre, you gotta get the katikoleti.
Now she say that she want me again. She won't come to me harder with me again. But we got no time for me say, I say, don't bring me back to your feelings, got all over. Did you choke all the games you play? Who did this one shaki to me sit again? Yes, see, Papi, you were not the one for me. So now you know that we cannot be together.
I got a collecting, say. Sweetie, sweetie, sweetie. Remember the good days, remember the good times.
I am wishing to hold you in my arms again, where I can kiss your lips and feel and touch you. Many, many things, baby, you're gonna like it, you're gonna like it. Tell me when it's gonna be, when are you coming home back to me? I wanna know, are you coming in June or July?
I did it. Yeah, yeah, this one a party time. Cause there's no stress, yeah, this one a party time. Cause life is too short, yeah, have to feel alright. Cause this is in my life, yeah.
Party mood, ain't no party mood, yeah. Party mood, no more party mood, yeah.
Be happy.
Hello, hello, hello.
I say be happy.
And you know, show your hands, show your hands. If you're happy and you know, show your hands up.
Everybody in here, Senjaga and Kula Benga, we're tired.
Yeah, my shiny border. Yeah, Mungu ni mwema. Sakano ndagetoni na uo, nange ndagetenye na uo. Kankwata wano, kwata wali jayo.
Don't I got the stretches, oh.
Osi chosi magira.
Be happy,
hello, hello,
hello. Be happy, oh, be happy,
hello, hello,
hello. Be happy, oh, be happy,
hello, hello,
hello. Be happy.
With the garden wine and shake shake. All the money we are to let so the garden wine and shake shake.
Mori them bosses in your mirror. Tiwali hoji vetambula.
You know God is good, friends are good. I'm stressless.
Be happy.
Hello, hello, hello.
Send me happy.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The expression Africa Rising has become popular in some section of the media for about a year or two. And without penetrating analysis of the essence of that expression, some African leaders have embraced it, aimed at demonstrating that they have been competent managers of the country's economy. But really, what does it mean? Are we being told that Africa is on the march? If anything, is that we can say the term may apply to the mining sector. True enough, when the mining sector is booming, growth rates are high, but do we also believe that trickle-down economy applies to these mining countries? Competent global economists have already debunked the idea of trickle-down, even in the industrial countries. If you take just one example, Sierra Leone was having a phenomenal growth rate when the mining companies were booming. But in the period of Ebola, many of these mining companies collapsed, the personnel left, and I think in one case, a company declared bankruptcy. And of course, the growth rate has depressed in Sierra Leone, and the economy is now in distress. But is it also a possibility that this expression, Africa rising, is an attempt to lull African leaders to sleep, to make them believe they are doing all right, and there is no need for them to turn to other pathways for development, for example, looking at China or India or Brazil? And the case of China is very tempting. A few years ago, this country was in deep poverty. Yet today, China has climbed out of that stage and is now the second functioning economy in the world next to the United States. China has been able to lift millions and millions of its people from poverty. Are we then being told that the best thing to do is to look to the Bretton Woods institutions and to follow the prescriptions that they have made, and there is no need to worry? I believe that African leaders and African economists should not be tempted, because we know that this expression does not apply to the millions of Africans who are still below the poverty level, nor does it apply to the crumbling infrastructure of Africa, which has impeded intra-African trade, which is in fact an essence for economic development in Africa, or even does it apply to the health sector in many African countries? As we saw in the Ebola case, the crumbling health sector made it very difficult to cope with that crisis. So the warning for Africa is, don't be misled by expressions which have no true meaning. We have eminent economists like Professor Adedeji who have written treatises about how best to proceed. Why don't we mobilize our economists for them to give us the true picture of our economy? Beware of false prophets. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Skip Skist. We say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, don't make a go to your friend if your skirt is made of leaves. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In 2009, President Barack Obama announced that under his administration, the United States would prioritize alleviating global hunger under nutrition and poverty. At the time, the global economic recession and rising food prices were forcing ever more people into food insecurity. So at the G8 summit in L'Aquila, Italy that year, President Obama committed an initial $3.5 billion to fight global hunger and poverty. Less than a year later, Feed the Future was born. It is an innovative initiative based on the premise that development efforts are most successful when the beneficiary countries determine their own food security needs and contribute to the effort. Led by the U.S. Agency for International Development, the initiative draws on 10 additional federal departments and agencies and investments from private sector partnerships. Today, it is clear that Feed the Future, coupled with other innovative U.S. government food security initiatives, are helping developing countries make substantial progress against hunger, poverty, and undernutrition. Last year alone, Feed the Future reached nearly 19 million households through assistance or training and helped bring new tools and technologies such as better seeds and fertilizers to nearly 7 million farmers. In fact, over the past 5 years in areas where Feed the Future works, the rate of childhood stunting, which indicates chronic malnutrition and leads to a host of developmental problems, has declined 9% in Ethiopia, 33% in Ghana, 25% in parts of Kenya, 21% in some areas of Cambodia, and 14.4% in areas of Bangladesh. Honduras and Bangladesh have seen a steep drop in poverty rates, and globally more than 12 million children receive nutrition interventions, such as vitamins and nutritional supplements, to help them grow and thrive. Much of the improvement has come as a result of Feed the Future's cooperation with a wide range of stakeholders to help smallholder farmers address the root causes of food insecurity and to increase economic opportunities. Through Feed the Future, the United States is partnering across borders and across sectors to unlock the transformative potential of agriculture, said USAID Associate Administrator Eric Postel. From Asia to the Caribbean to Africa, Feed the Future is helping raise crop yields and incomes, reduce stunting and poverty, and improve child nutrition. Going forward, USAID and our partners will continue working to ensure everyone has the nutritious food they need to lead full, healthy lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.